Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our talk show for the morning. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to welcome back to the program Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She has practice here in our area. Also, she teaches at the med school here in Urbana-Champaign at the U of I. And once a month on the program is here, we talk about women's health. Usually she comes and has in mind talking about a particular topic, and we can then take questions on that. But the idea is that whatever questions you might have, as long as they deal with her area of practice, you're welcome to call, and I know that she will do her best to give you an answer. I think one of the things I always try to mention when we have physicians on the program is obviously we cannot do diagnosis over the telephone. There are limits as to what we can do, but I do not want to discourage anyone from calling by saying that. I just want you to understand that that this might be a good place to start. You can ask some basic questions. We hope that these programs add to your basic knowledge about health. And then if you have concerns for yourself, obviously you need to go and take those up with your own physician. But this certainly is a place that you could start and ask basic questions, and that's certainly welcome. Here in Champaign, Urbana, where we are, the number to call, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number, 800-222-9455. Welcome back.
Good morning.
October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. We're almost through the month, but it's still a good thing to be talking. Even if it wasn't Breast Cancer Awareness Month, it would be a good thing to be talking about. So why don't we start there and talk about the basics on the issue.
Well, as we know, that the basics on the issue are that in the United States today, all women have about a 1 in 8 risk of breast cancer. So some people don't pay a lot of attention to additional risk factors because they feel like they already have very high risks. And I think that's true to some extent. But the number one risk factor is actually aging. And the older we get, the more risk we have. So that if you were to draw a graph between your age and your risk of breast cancer, it really shoots up in your 80s and 90s. Mm-hmm. On the same token, we talk about who actually needs mammograms. And we've been talking about people with family history or very lumpy breasts having mammograms at an earlier age. So in their early 30s, but really our pickup for mammograms is bigger in the later age groups. But there's also groups now saying that after a specific age, and there's some argument what that age might be, but say 85, something like that, 85, 90, maybe you can give up mammograms because the point of a mammogram is to pick up a lesion before it can actually be seen. But there's still a lot of work to be done in the area of mammograms. We know that there's about a 3% false negative rate, meaning that you get that card in the mail that says you passed your mammogram, it's completely negative, you don't need another mammogram for one full year. But in fact, 3 out of 100 women who get that, it's probably somewhat inaccurate. So we really started to progress in terms of using other technologies, fancy technologies like MRIs or even PET scans, which are positron emission tomography, which uses you take a radioactive dye and then you get a radiologic type study. But the problem with the MRIs specifically is we see too many UBOs. Do you know what a UBO is?
I have no idea.
You could probably guess what you usually stand for.
Unidentified some kind of object.
Exactly. Unidentified bright objects. Mm. So that when you actually look at the film, there are all these spots that show up brightly against the dark background of some of the rest of the breast tissue. And some of these bright spots can actually be a area of concern, but many of them are not. So that the problem with MRIs is that not only can we pick up more, but we pick up too much. And so we would need to do too many biopsies and too many extra studies on too many women in order to increase our pickup rate of breast cancer. And you may have read in the news that we already have a problem with this. In the United States, we do double the number of studies they do in England to pick up about the same rate of breast cancer in the general population, pick up about 6 cancers per 1,000 mammograms done. And in the United States, we do 2,000 mammograms for every 1,000 that they do. So we do a lot extra.
we have somebody here with a question. I tell you what, I'm sure there are a lot of other things we talk about, but why don't we, rather than make them wait, let's get to their question and invite others. If you have questions about breast cancer, obviously we can take those, or anything else, again, that falls in the area of women's health. That's what we're doing here this morning with Dr. Suzanne Truppen. The first caller is in Urbana, and line number one.
Good morning. I'm calling about the usefulness of B12 shots. Sometime back, when I was sort of dragging, I had a series of B12 shots. One the first week, then the next week another one, and then after several weeks a third one. And I'm just wondering what the opinion is at this point.
Well, it's one of those areas of medicine where many quote-unquote old-fashioned family-type docs, or in the old days we used to call them general practitioners. That term probably is passing from memory now, but I used to have literally legions of people that would come in periodically, like you, maybe once a week for a series, or maybe every couple, 3 weeks, literally year-round, for additional B12 shots for quote-unquote energy. Now, B12 is a very important vitamin, and it is certainly possible to get adequate B12 levels for most of us in the population from our diet. And it is true that some of us have diets that are deficient in nutrients for one reason or another. And there is a type of disease called pernicious anemia where people have very low B12 levels, and those individuals I'm separating out from people. I'm making the assumption that our caller does not have this disease, which
That's
is
right.
a fairly, rare blood disease. But the people who got the B12 shots, they would report increased energy, and it primarily was done for fatigue. Mm-hmm. And of course, when these shots were sort of developed as a treatment, we didn't have some of the sophisticated blood studies that we can do now. I mean, probably back then we couldn't even do a blood B12 level, which we certainly could do prior to giving somebody a B12 shot. So that in general, the use of these shots has passed from medical practice, other than the rare case where it just seems to do very well. Now, there are doctors that, and now we're getting a little bit from my field, but there are physicians that work in the area of just chronic fatigue who use B12 along with other things to treat conditions like that. But it's not as commonly used. But it's a very harmless treatment, and if it worked for you,
it did.
Great.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you for the call. Others are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, we can go back and talk some more about breast cancer. You said that in terms of risk factors, maybe one of the leading factors was age. That is, a woman's risk goes up significantly, and maybe really dramatically, as she gets older. There are other things that from time to time we've heard about as contributing. I'm thinking of the lifestyle factors, things like high fat in the diet, potential exposure to environmental toxins, smoking. Who knows, other sorts of things. Can we say with any sort of certainty that any of those sorts of things that would be easily modifiable, that is, something you can do about, have any connection?
We think that women who are obese, in other words, your BMI is over 30, or if you just want to get out the tape measure, if your waist is over 35 inches, those women probably have about a 20% increase in all cancers across the board. And this is certainly true for breast cancer. We do know that alcohol consumption is closely tied with risk for breast cancer as well. And this is certainly something that's modifiable. And people with any risk factors shouldn't drink on a daily basis and probably should talk to their own physician about it. Smoking is one of those weird, I always hate to bring this up, but smokers generally have a low estrogen level. In fact, smokers tend to be that low estrogen woman. Breast cancer patients tend to be that high estrogen woman. So if you look at the large epidemiologic studies, smokers have a lower risk of breast cancer. Now, they have a higher risk of bone disease and osteoporosis. So it's kind of interesting. If you get your bone density done and You're either prematurely osteopenic, low bone, or prematurely osteoporotic, actually osteoporosis. You actually don't skip your mammograms, but you actually are in a different category of risk and probably a lower category of risk than other women for breast cancer. Now, of course, inheriting breast cancer genes is a very important risk factor. Unfortunately, only about 3% of the population has these genes, so it's not like a test that we can just give the whole population. And it really would take a lot of money to search out these individuals other than taking genetic histories and then discussing from there. But of women who have carried the breast cancer gene 1 or the breast cancer gene 2, those women have about an 85% risk. Those statistics, I wouldn't write them down per se because they do vary from study to study, but a very high risk of breast cancer. And definitely other women who have other risk factors have increased risk. So maybe we can talk a little bit in a minute about how we go ahead and detect risks.
Okay. Well, we do have another caller here. This caller is in Iroquois County, so we'll talk with them on our line 4. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering about the blood test, a CA-125. I've been reading articles about it, that it's a somewhat of a diagnostic test for breast cancer. Can you tell me anything about that?
Well, CA-125 is a blood product that is elevated in a number of conditions. It's not particularly a good test for breast cancer, but it does go up in certain cases of ovarian cancer.
So, oh, that's what I meant.
Yeah, ovarian.
You know,
you're right.
I forgot about that.
Yeah.
I mixed up.
But I'm glad you brought it up because blood markers for cancer screening are very important kind of test, and they're very important for the future, so that we all know that men over the age of 50, they don't get their parts squeezed anywhere to get any special x-ray studies to look for prostate cancer. They just donate a little bit of their blood and they get screened for what's called a PSA test. And if that test is elevated, then they may in fact have prostate cancer and they get evaluated. Well, we have started to look at other cancers and specifically cancers in women to look for exactly this same type of thing. And CA-125 for ovarian cancer is one of the first tests, and it's relatively good. But the problem is that because it goes up in endometriosis and it goes up in, oh, maybe it's a little bit elevated in smokers or certain liver conditions, and the list goes on and on, that if you use CA-125 on the whole population and then you took abnormal results and tried to remove ovaries of women who have abnormal results, you'd probably end up removing about 350 ovaries, sets of ovaries. In other words, doing major operations, or you know, even if you want to do it laparoscopically and call it a minor operation, still doing a fairly intensive operation to get ovaries out of 350 women to maybe pick up a couple of cancers. So that test is really not recommended as universally being done. Now, if you have high risk for other reasons, if you have a mass detected on pelvic exam or pelvic ultrasound, or if you have any other questionable situations in your case, then it may be something that you and your physician together decide what to do with the test. But when it first came out, for instance, I had a number of patients who we were doing these tests on, and we found an abnormal result, but we couldn't figure out why it was abnormal. Their pelvic exam was normal, and their ultrasound was normal. So there were some women who decided that they didn't feel that they wanted their ovaries removed. We would just watch. Well, then over time, after years of watching, and the CA-125 stayed up, we eventually just gave up doing it because, you know, why still do the test if you're not going to pay attention to the answer? So that's the most important principle in medicine of all. Figure out what you're going to do with the test results before you order the test. Because if you're going to ignore the test results, then don't bother getting the test. And so CA-125 hasn't really been borne out as a great test. There are several other markers of ovarian cancer they're working on, and now there are two markers for breast cancer that people are really excited about that may start coming into general clinical use, but they're not. They're research-based only.
Well, I have another question about that. I'm wondering why, like a screening for CA125 for ovarian cancer, but if it was elevated, then you would then go on with ultrasound and various other things.
Right, and that's what the research studies have done. And that's what they did with about, this study was well more than 10 years ago. I don't think it was 20 years ago, but it could be getting close now. And they screened about 5,000 women. In the most famous study that people quote, they screened 5,000 women that way, where they took low-risk people, they just drew their CA125. Then if it was elevated, they did an ultrasound. Now, remember, some ovarian cancers do not have CA125 as one of the things they express. So there are some, it's specifically for epithelial cancers. So just by doing blood tests, you're going to miss some cancers anyway. And then they did ultrasound. And then if the ultrasound was abnormal and the CA125 was abnormal, these women agreed to have their ovaries removed. And 350 women had their ovaries removed out of this original group of 5,000 individuals. And of that group, they had five people with abnormalities. Two were probable ovarian cancers that they wouldn't have found otherwise. And one was a case where they discovered by talking to her that she probably shouldn't have been in the group to begin with because she had symptoms and hadn't really confessed about these symptoms. So they figured they would have found her anyway. And then two had borderline cancers. Not bad idea to remove them, but not malignancies. So 350 women lost their ovaries to pick up two cases. So that's one of those situations where you'd have to sit down and talk to your doctor. And, you know, are those good odds for you? We feel in the general medical field those odds aren't good enough yet.
So how does that relate to the PSA then for men? How many?
Oh, that's a good question. And you know what? Maybe I should know that answer. But being that's not my field, I don't know the statistics.
I just wondered if the much higher percentage of positive PSAs would result in accurate diagnosis.
One of the problems with PSAs is if men live long enough, practically all of them get prostate cancer. And I know we have a family doc that comes in who must order that and talks on the radio, Dr. Swearingen, periodically. That might be a good question.
Yeah. Well, I think the other thing about people who, you know, particularly people who specialize that and say about the PSA is one thing you have to remember about the PSA is it's prostate specific. It's not cancer specific.
Yes.
You know,
correct.
So just the fact that it's elevated doesn't, you know, you could have a prostate infection, you could have prostatitis. And get a
good
high
point.
PSA. So there's lots of questions about, okay, you do that test, especially if you do that test to a lot of men. So then what do? Particularly given the fact that it's a very slow growing cancer and a lot of
right.
men, even, you know, if they have prostate cancer, chances are they're going to die of something else.
Before.
And also because, you know, there can be some nasty side effects of the treatment. You know, the possibility that you might end up with urinary incontinence or sexual dysfunction, which is a lot of guys would say, well, you know, that doesn't sound real good to me. And especially if you're saying, I may die of something else, you know, it makes it harder, I think, to decide, okay, you got this diagnosis. Even if you take it to the point of saying, okay, you actually have prostate cancer, then what do you do? How aggressively do you decide to treat?
And I think this is what doctors are coming up with when we say that perhaps you get to a certain age where it isn't necessary to still do screening tests because a pinpoint cancer in a woman who is of a certain age and only has a few years to live anyway, chasing it with surgeries or whatever probably is more detrimental to her health than letting that very small cancer perhaps stay as it is for a while. It's a question.
Thank you for your explanation.
All right, thank you. We're getting close to the midpoint here. Our guest is Dr. Suzanne Troop, and she's an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She teaches at U of I College of Medicine, also has a practice here in our area once a month. She's on this program. We talk about women's health. And if you have a question, I know she'll do her best to give you an answer. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We did have someone who asked the question off the air who was interested in what you do for screening for a woman who might be breastfeeding, because apparently you can't have a mammogram if you're breastfeed?
Well, we get that question both for what do you do in a pregnant mom and what do you do for a breastfeeding mom. And, of course, this is where pregnancy planning comes in. So if you're age 35, you're thinking about getting pregnant, I definitely recommend that you have that mammogram before you conceive, because basic screening exams while you're pregnant or breastfeeding are significantly less accurate because all the fluid that physiologically then accumulates in your breast and makes that mammogram not very good. But it's not completely inaccurate, so that if we have some reason to do what's called a diagnostic mammogram, in other words, if a woman has a mass, then you really still need that mammogram to help decide what's going on with that mass, and certainly the baby can be shielded if she's pregnant, or obviously breastfeeding is not so much of an issue. But for a basic type case where there's no specific mass and no specific urgency, we usually recommend till about 3 to 6 months after you're done breastfeeding to repeat that basic screening mammogram.
Okay. We have another caller here, Indianapolis, I believe, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Say, I'm about to have angioplasty. I'm 75 years old, and I've had a family with hemophilia, and it was tested at Mayo Clinic, and I've been listed as have the disease. And I have 4 daughters that are carriers, and I have 5 grandsons with hemophilia. And I'm wondering, should I get a new hemophilia test before I go into angioplasty?
Well, most of those tests are fairly accurate, and it will not change over time. Those tests are either positive or negative based on your genetic heritage, which does sound significant in your family. So I would just make sure that your cardiovascular surgeon knows your history and has a copy of your test results, and if they want to order additional testing, they would.
He seems not to want to have to order that, and that's what's got me upset. And children, my kids, say that they don't want me under surgery if I get a chance to bleed, you know, inside there with hemophilia.
Sometimes it's good to bring a health advocate with you. In other words, one of your family members or somebody else that can interpret why your physician is satisfied with the reports that they have and make sure you guys are all talking the same language.
Okay, well, I like to have a hemophilia test, and the cardiovascular says he wouldn't order it. So I don't know what to do.
Well, it's usually something that you could even talk to your family doctor about. So I would take a family member with you and sit down with your family doctor and see if testing's indicated in your case.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We have another off-air question. Someone would like some discussion of fibrocystic disease.
Well, fibrocystic breast condition has been, it's been, you know, one of those renamed. We used to call it fibrocystic breast disease. Now we call it fibrocystic breast condition because about 7 out of 10 women do develop this. And what it seems to be is a thickening of the actual walls of the ducts of the breast, such that the opening between the glands of the breast and the duct sort of gets relatively compressed. And so fluid accumulates back in the ducts, from the ducts in the glands, and the glands therefore get small fluid accumulations and feel fairly lumpy. So a woman with fibrocystic breast has sometimes painful, occasionally large single lumps, but more often multiple small lumps that vary, maybe get a little bit bigger on parts of her menstrual cycle. In and of itself, because it's so common, we don't think that it's any particular significance other than the discomfort factor, but any condition like this that gives that much lumpiness to the breast can obscure, say, a serious cancer-type lump that develops, so that if you look at large studies, they can detect a slightly increased cancer risk in women with fibrocystic breast condition, but we don't think it's the condition that produces the cancer, but the condition that masks finding the cancer. So that's what we think's going on. We've never really found a great treatment. Some people think decreasing caffeine, increasing vitamin E consumption, actually being on birth control pills helps to control it in some women. And there have been a number of other treatments. Danicrin, an old-fashioned treatment for endometriosis, works very well, but has a 6 out of 100 risk of producing male-type hormone side effects. So just most doctors just never use Danicrin for treatment of it. Actually, water pills have been tried, but they don't really work very well either. I was once participating in a study where we were trying a new treatment for it. Didn't work, so the study never went anywhere. But it's something that we can't really effectively treat, but that each woman who has this condition should probably talk to her own physician about and see how this is going to affect your plans for breast self-exams, clinical exams with your own physician, and mammograms.
Okay. Urbana is our next caller, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Two things about the two male issues that were just talked about. As I recall, hemophilia, I think, is carried on the X chromosome. And so if a male has the X chromosome, he has an X chromosome and a Y chromosome. So if he, this man, if he had that X chromosome with a hemophilia gene, he would have hemophilia and it would always express itself.
Well, yes, it would be very unusual. What you're saying is correct. It would be very unusual to get to old age and not have known about it. But there are variances in what we call phenotypic expression. So, and I don't remember, but for hemophilia, how common this is. But there are certain genetic diseases where you can actually carry the genetic disease but have such a mild variant that you don't come to diagnosis till much later in life, like when you're in your 30s or 40s or 50s. This man was 76, so the chances that he would have a genetic condition that he really doesn't know about like that would be really small.
And the other thing is that, you know, I always heard that prostate cancer often was very slow growing, but if you get it in your 50s, it may not be so slow growing and you have less time and you have more of a life expectancy for it to grow. So men shouldn't put off getting their PSA test because they've heard that it's slow growing. I've known of men who've skipped a test in a year, and then the second year they've gone for their physical, and the PSA level's up, and the cancer is there. But if it's caught early, I think you have more options, and there are more options now besides surgery that have the potential for much fewer side effects. So it's to the advantage for men to have the PSA test done, to have it followed up and find out if it's elevated, what's causing the elevation. So I just wanted to...
I think those are excellent points, and I think the sort of the bottom line is that you don't really decide based on, you know, a couple of comments you hear on the air whether or not to have a test or not have a test. What you want is what's called informed consent. And informed consent, no matter what you're doing in medicine, is, for many of us, it's a matter of signing a form. And we really shouldn't look at informed consent as a matter of signing a form. We should think of it as a process of education and decision making. And that process should, of course, take your own physician's thoughts about your case into consideration and all these things in the literature. And what you want is to either make an informed choice to do something or make a very informed choice to refuse the test. And one aspect of refusal is, you know, what can happen if you catch something early versus late. So that is a very important decision-making process in informed refusal. And we don't really talk about informed refusal very much, but actually in medicine it goes on every day.
Well, there's many steps between the PSA test. I think they do multiple tests, and they would do a biopsy if they suspected cancer beyond the PSA test. So there's plenty of opportunity.
Sure.
But if you put off having the test done because you think, the chances of a 50-something-year-old man getting it is pretty low, you know, you could be playing the odds wrong. It's so easy to put off getting tests done because, you know, you're healthy. You think, I've got other things to do. Anyway, that was my point. Thanks a bunch.
Thanks for the call. And I suppose, it's not a particularly invasive test. All it involves is a blood draw, so... I guess you can go from there. Anyway, we're talking about women's health this morning on Focus 580.
We're trying to.
And our guest is Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She's an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She's on the program every month, always on a Monday. We talk about women's health. And questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, I have another question here, another off-the-air question here from someone who is interested in treating hot flashes. And the question is, if a woman chooses to take the estrogen progesterone combination for hot flashes, she would like to know what's the lowest dose that is available, and would it be beneficial to take it every other day if the combination pill works for hot flashes?
Well, if a woman is considering taking an estrogen-progesterone combination, I'm going to make the assumption that this person still has a uterus, because you don't need the progesterone portion of the combination if you do not have a uterus. And if you do have a uterus and you have to take a combination because you have progesterone, if you mess around with your dosing and take it every other day, you may be precipitating some spotting or bleeding that you're then going to have to deal with. So that may not be a good strategy. Definitely we can use lower doses than we've used in the past. Some women require much greater doses than other women, so it has to be something that you work with your own physician on. Some women only have severe symptoms for 6 months or a year, and so there's no reason to necessarily take your hormones for 20 years if you're treating a six-month condition. So trials off the medicine are becoming a lot more popular in our attempts to decrease the total years that people use their hormones. There are tons of different ways you can dose estrogen formulations. You can take it vaginally, you can take it in a skin cream, you can take it orally, or you can take an injection. And now we have, in addition to the standard vaginal preparations, we have a ring that leaks so much estrogen that you actually get systemic blood levels, albeit relatively lower than some doses of oral medication. So working with your own physician and trying to come up with a low dose that's high enough to have a reasonable chance of physiologic benefit and low enough to preserve safety is probably the best way to go.
Okay. Other questions certainly are welcome. We have about, about 15 minutes or so on the program with Dr. Truppen. Let's go. At the beginning, we were talking a little bit about breast cancer, and you said maybe it would be a good idea to talk about how it is you assess risk. I mean, we talked about, various under risk factors.
Absolutely. And I have talked about this a little bit before, but still when I talk directly to patients and I meet new patients, very few patients still seem to be aware of this. And we use actual tools that have been validated by research and supported by organizations such as the National Institute of Health to ask women a few simple questions and come up with an actual statistical calculation of risk, and then based on those statistical calculations, some women are recommended to do other things like take tamoxifen, for instance, for prevention. And there are several tools out there, but the most popular one is something called the Gale Scale. And you can go on to the National Institute of Health website, go to breast cancer, and it's Gale, G-A-I-L. Scale, or many of your doctors may have received a disc where they can just pop it into their old PC and work through the questions for you and calculate your risk. And I really encourage people to do that worksheet, get their statistical risk, and then sit down with their own physician and talk about what does this mean for my case. And we use the Gale Scale in women over the age of 35. Every woman over the age of 35, she can put her numbers in and see what her risk is.
Okay, let's see. We have some other calls. Let's go to Charleston, line number 4. Hello?
Hello.
Yes.
I'm wondering about the effectiveness of Actonol versus Fosamax for treating osteoporosis.
Those are great questions. They're both bisphosphonates. They work through a very similar mechanism. They're both excellent drugs. I support the use of both of them. Actonel has been shown in research to have a little bit of a quicker start on the spine because of the way they did their research. We don't know if that would bear out if it was done exactly the same way with Fosmax research. And Actonel has a little bit higher metabolic turnover, so that it's a little bit less likely that Actonel is going to persist in your bones for long periods of time. They're both tolerated very well. They both can be given as a daily dose or a once-a-week dose, and they both are indicated for both the prevention and treatment of osteoporosis. And I know there are some health plans out there that support one drug over another.
Yeah, that's right.
And which is, I suspect, why you're calling, but that's just a guess. But yeah. So for my patients where there's a big price difference, I usually go ahead and switch the bisphosphonate that that her insurance company will support, unless for one reason or another she doesn't tolerate one medicine, then sometimes it's worth trying the other one.
Okay. What about myocalcin, which is a nasal spray? Do you think that's effective for treatment of osteoporosis?
Myocalcin's a very good drug. It's very effective for the treatment of osteoporosis, although it's got some different kind of data in terms of prevention of fractures in different sites than the Actonel and the bisphosphonate, and it's not indicated for prevention of osteoporosis. It's indicated for treatment of osteoporosis.
Okay.
So it's a little bit different drug and not used as much by the primary care provider.
Okay. That helps a lot. Thank you very much.
All right. And the next caller is in Burlington, Illinois, line number one. Hello?
Yes, hi. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if taking calcium supplements could, you know, to prevent the osteoporosis, could actually increase your risk of other things such as calcium deposits in the arteries or kidney stones or the breast calcium deposits. A lot of people I know are getting those heart scans, and they're finding out that they're being described as calcium deposits in the arteries.
Well, calcium deposits in the arteries have more to do with atherosclerosis and other factors that lead to deposits in their arteries, and the deposit picks up calcium out of the bloodstream. And these are individuals that typically would have a normal blood calcium level.
Oh.
And we think that calcium supplementation is extraordinarily safe. Now, they've even done some studies to show that calcium supplementation, even at fairly high levels, does not produce increased risk of calcium kidney stones. But I always advocate my patients stick within recommended guidelines. And the recommended guidelines vary for exactly who you are and what age you are and whether or not you have any pre-existing osteoporosis. So you probably want to talk to your own healthcare provider, but the average listening woman out there probably needs 800 milligrams a day, and anybody listening who has osteoporosis probably needs 1,200 milligrams a day. It is true that citrated calcium is better absorbed. It is true that if you swallow your calcium pill with your diet pop, that the phosphorus in the pop binds some of the calcium. But in general, for most of us, any supplement we get is going to provide excellent calcium supplementation, and you don't really have to fuss too much between supplements unless something else is going on. Calcium blood levels are very easy to draw, and if there's any reason to believe that you've completely overdone it, you can get a blood level of calcium.
Okay.
But the breast has is designed to make milk, and milk has calcium. So the breast tissue does have a lot of calcium in it anyway, regardless of our oral supplementation level. I can't speak specifically for the heart itself. I don't know the answer to that, but I don't think that calcium supplementation could lead to an abnormal test.
Oh, thank you. I have one other question about taking calcium. I heard some people saying you shouldn't take it with orange juice, but I know there are a lot of orange juices that are fortified with calcium.
No, actually, taking it with orange juice is supposed to be good because the citrate does help to absorb the calcium. I think we really don't have to fuss that much with how we take our calcium. What I try to tell my patients is to pay a little bit of attention to what you're getting in your food. Most milk portions have 200 to 300 milligrams of calcium in it, and say a portion of broccoli may even have up to 100 milligrams of calcium in it. Even a whole potato can have 60. of calcium. And so pay a little bit of attention to what you're getting. Pickled herring has high levels of calcium, not a big food in the Midwest, but there may be some listeners out there who love it. Nuts are very high in calcium. So if you pay attention to what you've got in your food and then supplement up to your required levels. Now, if you pay no attention to what you're getting in your food and you're taking complete supplementation on top of that, your levels will get up a little bit high, and I tend to discourage that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Very good. Thank you for the call. Again, about 10 minutes left. Other people have questions, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Some other things you want to say about breast cancer?
I did. One thing that's been really interesting is that we didn't get a chance to mention about risk. And, you know, there are a lot of risk factors that we can talk about. And when we talk about doing those Gale scale calculations, you'll quickly discover that they don't even ask about every single thing of risk. For instance, Gale scale does not ask you whether you've taken estrogen or not, which we now think in the menopausal age group may in fact be a risk factor. But doing shift work can actually affect your breast cancer risk. And that women who work at night on night shifts who may have abnormalities in their melatonin levels, this could be the possible explanation, have been found to have a greater risk of breast cancer, which is kind of interesting. So maybe the night workers just shouldn't skip their mammograms.
We're getting in another caller here, and again, we'll do as many questions as we have time for. We have a person here listening is Urbana, and they're next here, line number one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, I'm actually in Champaign. Okay.
Oh, pardon me? Go ahead. Well, wherever you are, go ahead.
The right line.
Yes.
I have a question about bladder infections. I am one of those women that apparently has gets bladder infections that are related to sexual activity. And what I've been told is, well, some women are just like that, and there's nothing you can really do about it. And I haven't really been very satisfied with that answer. And I wondered if there's anything beyond just the drinking cranberry juice and drinking lots of water or anything that I can do or any new medications, anything that I can do to prevent this from happening, because basically it's one of those things where, you know, it happens and then you have to go and take a bunch of antibiotics and there doesn't seem to be a really good prevention strategy.
Well, one of the best prevention strategy that we recommend for people who get three or more bladder infections per year is to actually take a very low dose of antibiotic after intercourse at night before you go to bed. And that's something that you may want to talk to your own healthcare provider about. There are a couple of different types of antibiotics that are used. And of course, you got to take your own allergies into consideration. Mm-hmm. But that strategy seems to work great for people who can't do the simple things. And I'll talk about the simple things here in a second. And if you've had that many infections, just, you know, over the phone, which we don't really like to give too much advice over the phone. Someone like you might definitely have that treatment recommended, and you should definitely discuss that with your gynecologist or your primary health care provider. Now, other things that have been linked to bladder infections are these condoms,
mm-hmm.
having sex itself, but we probably wouldn't recommend giving that up. Cervical caps and diaphragms, but diaphragms more so than cervical caps are two things. One, it's thought that it's possible that the latex in condoms or the diaphragm or perhaps the spermicide can change either the types of bacteria or the nature of bacteria, particularly E. coli, and make them more likely to latch on to your bladder wall and produce an infection. There's simple things like you're supposed to go to the bathroom after you have intercourse before
right.
you go to bed. And the other thing is that some people don't, the other thing is to be sure you're getting an accurate diagnosis. Like, you know, like all the other doctors, I occasionally get calls, you know, on the weekend or at night, I got a bladder infection, I'm miserable, call something in, doc. And I do it like many other doctors do. But in fact, if you've had recurrent infections, it's better to actually get a culture. Make sure, in fact, you are having an infection so that you don't over-treat.
Mm-hmm.
But the simplest thing is probably going ahead and using the antibiotics.
Okay, and that would negate using birth control pills, correct? Because the antibiotics can make the birth control pills less effective?
Well, no. Birth control pills and antibiotic use. If you read the package insert on most birth control pills, it says if you're taking an antibiotic, your pills may be less effective. They never say they're going to be not effective at all. Okay. So the statistical failure rate might go up. We don't really know why that is, because if we actually do blood levels on women with antibiotic use, their blood levels when they're on the pill and off the pill, I mean, on the antibiotic, their pill blood levels on the antibiotic and off the antibiotic are identical. We don't quite know why that is. Maybe people will skip their pills or something. We're not sure. It's certainly worthwhile to, when you have to use the antibiotic, to use a backup if you should decide to do that. But when we're talking about the pills and antibiotic interaction, these are people getting full courses of antibiotics. They're taking maybe 2 to 4 doses per day for an intense period of time, like 1 to 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. This is a very low dose after intercourse kind of thing. So you're not getting the levels of antibiotics that you would otherwise.
Okay. And I have two hopefully quick questions. I was told that too much calcium in your bloodstream could cause you to have more bladder infections, because something about making your urine more basic as opposed to acidic. And also I've been told that I'm young and that the longer I'm married and, you know, that these will go away. Is that true as well?
Well, there's no doubt about it that switching partners increases your risk for getting infections. So if you equate young to switching partners, which in our general population, there is some of that that may have a factor. But strictly being married or unmarried, probably
well,
not a big factor.
I'm with one person.
Yeah. In terms of too much calcium, they're really talking about people precipitating a kidney, ureteral or bladder stone, an actual stone. If you get a stone, it can even lead to an infection. But there's no direct link between having a bladder infection and your calcium levels.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. We are just about at the end of the time. Was there anything you want to talk about?
Well, we were talking a lot about nutrition, and there have been some interesting studies about chromium. I get a lot of questions about the kinds of everybody's interested in supplementing their diet, and I think supplements can be very important, particularly for those of us either on the run, so perhaps eating more spotty than we should, or those of us dieting. Many of us diet all the time, and it's been pretty interesting. Chromium has been shown that can actually decrease the amount of medicine that type 2 diabetics, diet-controlled or oral medication-controlled diabetics, keeps their blood sugar under better control. Now, the studies haven't really shown that chromium supplements in normal individuals can prevent them from getting diabetes, but it's been kind of an intriguing idea. So it's a supplement that rarely has any side effects, maybe some GI side effects, and you should definitely keep within the recommended amounts, because super high levels of chromium, say 3 to 4 times the recommended amounts on the jar, can lead to toxicity, but in the regular dose range seems to be very well tolerated.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks.